Sunday afternoon at Mount Stuart with the rain coming down on us, but we'll be raining with conversation in this room any minute now. My name is William Crawley. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to this discussion, conversation, and you will be involved, hopefully, in the conversation about diplomacy and about what diplomacy is now, what it's been in the past, and what it may become in the future. And to help us have that conversation, we're joined by a former British ambassador and a former Irish ambassador. Noel Fahy was the Irish ambassador to the United States and also to the Holy See. And we're delighted to have you with us, Noel. And Dame Glyn Evans was British ambassador in a number of roles, involved in peace building, multilateral work, and also bilateral work between Britain and other countries. So we want to have a conversation about their experiences of diplomacy, and also the relationship between Britain and Ireland as a diplomatic partnership, and where it might all go from here. Let's welcome our guests to the big tent. Are you worried already? So can I start straight away by saying, I mean, once an ambassador, always an ambassador? Is that how it works, Noel? Or are you going to tell us what you really think today?
Of course I'll tell you what I really think. Ambassadors always tell people what they really think.
I need your definition, Glyn, of diplomacy, because obviously we've got those comedy definitions out there. A diplomat is someone who lies for his country, dines for his country. We've heard them all before. A diplomat is a man who thinks twice before saying nothing. That's another famous one. You know, what's your understanding of diplomacy? What is the game?
It's promoting your country and promoting influence, and in accordance with the funds that are available. These days it's all about resources. And in that promotion, you will use a lot of different tools. It's no longer just ambassadors and embassies. It's a variety of different tools across a broad spectrum.
So promoting your salesmanship, that's it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Basically that, salesmanship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's promoting your country, but it's also reporting the country you're in to your own people. I think that's a very important function as well.
Nothing in that definition about making the world a better place for everybody?
Well, I think it's implicit in promoting your country and in reporting on the country you're in, that it helps to make the world a better place, hopefully for both.
I'd use the word also influencing, and in influencing, that will contribute to helping make the world a better place, because you're influencing towards a particular end that might be to contribute to a peace settlement, which we've heard from Jonathan Powell just now. It might be influencing for the benefit of the UK interests. But the UK's strategic interest is always to have as peaceful a world as it's possible to get.
Do you have a good understanding of what Irish diplomacy is as opposed to British diplomacy? And vice versa, question for you, Noel. I mean, what is your understanding of how the other side in this conversation does this?
Well, I mean, opposed is not a word I'd use because, especially in the last 20 years, we've worked very closely together promoting the peace process.
Yeah.
We do have interests that don't always coincide, particular economic interests, agriculture, for instance, where we might take a different point of view. But broadly, we take a similar view. We both promote peace. We promote from a different point of view. We see the world perhaps from a different point of view in that context. But we're both moving in the same direction in the European Union. We tend very often to be on the same side. We're in favor.
You used to move in the same direction on the European Union.
Well, yes, I'm still recovering. I'm still trying to come to terms with
the
Brexit.
The trauma of it all, I know.
But I'm glad to say I'm not the only one. But I mean, I would say...
I think that was Boris Johnson.
We do work pretty closely together, and we work especially in the EU towards common ends, or have done up to now.
Yeah.
I think where I've worked most closely with Irish diplomats has been at the UN, where I have to say they are very cunning and wily diplomats in multilateral fora. And my particular Irish opposite number was a great one for isolating the Brits. Together, he would work with the Indians and they'd start getting very post-colonial on the UK mission. I'd point out I was Welsh, but that didn't matter.
Yeah, because of course you can use the fact that you're a small country as a massive benefit in diplomacy, can't you?
It cuts both ways. I mean, if you try to contrast the British system with ours, it's much bigger. The British embassies are bigger, great deal bigger than Irish embassies. We used to say back in the 70s, it may not still be quite so true, that there were more diplomats in the British embassy in Washington than there were in the whole of the Irish Foreign Service. Right. I don't think that's the case quite anymore, partly because of cutbacks in the British system, and partly because of an increase in ours. Also, British interests as a permanent member of the Security Council, as a member of NATO, British interest and, of course, its position in the international economic order, its position in the G7, G8, has a larger economic interest than we do. So the role of a British mission would be wider than ours. We have to focus on issues that are of particular concern to us, peace process over the years, our economic interests, foreign direct investment and trade. And on the other side of that, the Irish community, I suppose a particular familiarity with the Irish community because I spent 5 years in Washington, but anybody who served in London or in Australia, just to mention two other places, or a place like Argentina, the community would be very, very important to us, both for what positive feedback we could have from the community and what we could deliver to the community. So perhaps our focus is a bit narrower than the British, inevitably because of our size. But that's not
part of the story.
Glyn has mentioned the role in the UN. We attach particular importance to the role of international organizations, and that's inevitable with a small country because the small countries rely on a functioning international system to protect their interests. I'm not saying the British are in any way inimical to a functioning international system, quite the contrary. But if there are problems and if that system breaks down or is not working, Britain is in a stronger position to defend its interests than we are. We rely very much on a functioning system of international law.
I would say that one other area where I have seen the Irish at work, of course, has been in the context of peacekeeping.
Yes.
They have a very well-established one. I spent a lot of my career looking at peacekeeping missions and helping promote that, and have a great deal of respect for those kinds of activities. What Noel says inevitably is right. I mean, British embassies can range from one person who does all the jobs himself. I regard as sort of an opera director with no orchestra and no singers. He does them all. And one where you have, like Washington or Berlin or Paris, perhaps, a huge number of people from a wide range of departments. Most of them are not diplomats. They will come from the Treasury, from agriculture, from National Crime Agency. And the poor wretched ambassador, going back to my opera director, is trying to make them all sing to the right tune according to the score, knowing perfectly well that they're on the telephone back to their headquarters at any given moment.
Yes.
It's
and they're rewriting the score
and they're
as
rewriting
you're singing it.
Well, they're not singing it terribly well.
Let me also want to show off some of our BBC archive. We have a documentary, Palace of Dreams. I'm sure you've seen it, where we go in behind the doors of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Let's have a look at this. I'll get your response to what you see in a second.
You were clear it was an elite service and that it had a different examination and the people were grand. It was awesome. The actual building, which was then dark and rather dirty and very post-war, we're talking about 1952, but it was awesome.
Well, I think I was rather terrified of the Foreign Office when I first went there. Anyone above the age of about 40 was still wearing a bowler hat every day, was wearing a black jacket and pinstripe trousers. And even at my insignificant level, we were expected to wear stiff white collars to be laundered every day sort of thing. And the old system of the Foreign Office still prevailed. The most junior officers desk officers sat there in groups of three or four in front of coal fires, which were topped up by messengers every hour or two.
The Foreign Office was very masculine, extremely few women. We had an awful lot of sporting metaphors when I joined the Foreign Office. We kept straight bats on sticky wickets against pretty fast bowling, and we went home at close of play.
Yes!
Foreign Office people always had a special something, and they were almost the last generation for whom the word duty could be used without people smirking. At the top end, they recruited from very clever people, very competitive. It was a remarkable accolade if you were a 22 or 23-year-old to be offered a place in the diplomatic service, you see. And it still is. They still recruit wonderfully well.
In contrast to the domestic civil service, people in the diplomatic service have, as the Scots would say, a very fine conceit of themselves. Certainly, if they were suffering from any self-doubt, they didn't just show it.
You mean they were rather superior?
Well, it could be. I mean, I actually got on with them absolutely fine, but one or two predecessors have had a difficult time in the Foreign Office. I mean, if you're not up to snuff, as they would say, you'd get spat out.
Does that ring any bells, Glenn?
Well, I think this is a little before my time.
No, I don't mean chronologically. In terms of the culture.
Yes. When I joined the Foreign Office, ambassadors, for instance, were His Excellency, and you addressed them as Your Excellency. They were entirely male. It's quite true, there weren't many women around at that time. And it was very, very hierarchical. There were lots of little fish at the bottom in the third rooms, and they went up through sort of various layers of fishes to the grandee, to the ambassador. One of my predecessors in Lisbon, when he arrived there, arrived with a personal entourage of 40 people, including his chaplain and his mistress. So, you know, things... But nowadays, you have a very flat organization. Hierarchies have more or less gone away with the dodo. As an ambassador, my staff would say, what do we call you? I'd say, you call me Glyn. However, if it's an old-fashioned country, when visitors come in, please lay on the trimmings and call me ambassador, because they don't altogether understand it if you're calling the ambassador by their Christian name. In my day, that would have been totally unthinkable. And more than that, you have all these people from home departments who sort of have also, and outsiders, you have quite a lot of implants from NGOs, from others. So it's a very flat, non-hierarchical system, probably more so than most other countries. We've gone from one extreme to the other.
Yeah. In Matthew Paris's book, where he gathers, you know what I'm going to ask, where he gathers valedictory emails, I suppose we call them today, but final memos from diplomats like yourself, you're in there, he includes your valedictory piece, and you reflect a little bit about your time in the service and say how you were a maverick and you don't think you'd even get into the service, the way it's changed over the years.
I also said that to the BBC in True Brits, actually, that I was recruited in the maverick quota.
Yeah.
Well, I was a woman and a Catholic, and they didn't recruit many of either at the time.
Yeah.
And also, there's a sort of management tool where you assign people to different kinds of categories, creator, innovators, thruster, organizers, and so on. And most of the Foreign Office, we were told by the business, London Business School, were thruster organizers. I came in as a creator innovator, which made me very happy. Because people who I think this is well established now, tend to recruit people like themselves. Hmm. And I always felt I was an outlier, and my patterns of thought were quite different to those of my colleagues, which sometimes were good, because you would come up with an idea when people were stuck for some kind of solution to an intractable problem. Mm. But sometimes you were saying, oh, go away, Glyn, that's a silly idea.
Why did you want to join the Foreign Service?
Well, I didn't, actually. I was happily being an academic. My parents say, why didn't you sit the exam? So I sat the exam and said, all right, why don't you try it for a year or two? And so 34 years later, there I still was.
So you became an ambassador to please your parents?
No, I became a diplomat to please my parents, and I stayed, actually, because it turned out to be a tremendous amount of fun, more particularly at headquarters in London than overseas.
Noel, why did you want to join the Foreign Service?
I fell into the Foreign Service. I did the competition, got it, to my surprise. Couldn't turn it down because it meant a reasonably well-paid job. Got what I wanted shortly afterwards. That was the equivalent of assistant principal in the finance ministry. And after 6 months in the finance ministry, I realized I'd made a mistake. And 3 years later, I had a chance to repair the damage, go back to the foreign ministry, more or less at the level I would have reached had I stayed. And then I stayed for nearly 40 years and enjoyed every minute of it. More, a bit like Glenn, not always enjoyed all of the posts I was in abroad, and I'd make an exception in the case of Washington, or enjoyed as much as being the head of a division at home. There is a certain kind of particular satisfaction being head of a division at home.
Was it very hierarchical
when you joined? No, it was hierarchical in the way the civil service was hierarchical in the 60s and 70s and had been. We come from a different tradition to the British. The idea of establishing a foreign service for an independent Ireland wasn't particularly welcomed in the 20s. In fact, there were efforts to abolish it. It was always treated very much as a Cinderella of the civil service, a rather exotic breed kind of attached on. It didn't have the kind of... I mean, it had respect, but it didn't have the kind of cachet within our system that the Foreign Office has within the British system, or appears to outsiders to have. It was hierarchical, but it was also, you had to be ready to turn your hand to anything, because it was such a small service. You might be dealing with a citizen in trouble one day, you might be at a major diplomatic reception another day, and another day you might be dealing with a trade issue. I mean, the missions were small, so the range of duties were very, very wide. That tended to keep people grounded. The hierarchy has been squashed, perhaps not as far as the British system, but it has been squashed in the last 10, 15 years. But I think that's something that's happening in services throughout the world.
That's interesting, isn't it? The British Foreign Service is less hierarchical now, you think, than the Irish?
I wouldn't say it's less hierarchical, but I would say that because we weren't quite, I think, as hierarchical as the British system in the first place. But... Yes, I'm interested in what Glenn has to say and what I've seen myself from talking to British colleagues, how much it has changed.
Also want to find out about how you think we, the people outside of the Foreign Service, see the Foreign Service and the officials, the people who work there. But as a way into that, can I show you another clip? This is actually a splicing together of three different perspectives. Some humorous, some, you know, straight bat, as they say in the Foreign Office. Looking at the officials. Let's go to this.
The Honourable David Gore Booth is a highly ambitious diplomat in a high-pressure job. He heads the Middle East Department and was one of Douglas Hurd's chief advisors during the Gulf War. He will soon be going to Saudi Arabia to take up his first ambassadorship.
I'm having to deal with and be knowledgeable about 21 countries or whatever it is. The need for instant, often, but always considered advice on what the hell is going on and what the hell we should do about it is considerable. And it's a persistent machine gun-like existence.
The latest crisis is Saddam Hussein's persecution of the Shias in southern Iraq.
Perhaps if you could send a senior minister out here...
Oh, be sensible. No one wants to go to Tazbekistan. You sound like your predecessor. No, we need to win this contract because these stans are the future. I want you to get very close to this president, Davis. Sniff the armpit. But not too close. I don't want any embarrassing Blair-Gaddafi handshakes. Close enough to be able to find out what they want from us and what we want from them, that's the policy, but with enough distance to be able to extricate ourselves if things go tits up.
Gotcha. Close but distant.
That's it.
This directive comes from Brussels, saying that all EEC members must conform to some niggling European word processing standards. that we have to agree to the plans of masses of European word processing committees at the forthcoming European Word Processing Conference in Brussels. Well, say something.
Yes, Minister.
Quite so.
Is that all you want to say?
Well, Minister, I'm afraid that is the penalty we have to pay for trying to pretend that we're Europeans. Believe me, I fully understand your hostility to Europe.
I'm not like you, Humphrey. I'm pro-Europe. I'm just anti-Brussels. You sometimes think you're anti-Europe and pro-Brussels.
Oh, Minister, I'm neither pro nor anti-anything. I'm merely a humble vessel into which ministers pour the fruits of their deliberations.
The meetings offer Foreign Office diplomats the chance to deploy their deal-making skills and then to compose a communique for the media on what the Council of Ministers had actually agreed.
The communiques, of course, were they drove you really up the pole, because there's nothing that bureaucrats like better than drafting. And when you get, as we were then, 12 members of the community drafting a communique, every comma, every apostrophe was queried, the translation between English and French, the nuances, it went on and on and on and on.
On and on and on. How do you think diplomats are seen by non-diplomats, Glyn?
Poof. I think they are still seen rather as in the earlier clips you showed, as living the high life in rather grand buildings and sipping gin and tonics on the terrace after six. And it's only those who actually, as people travel the world and when they get into trouble and they get support from a consul, they begin to understand that actually one of the biggest priorities of any ambassador is to look after fellow nationals. Those words on the inside of your passport actually mean something. If there is any kind of event overseas, a bus goes over a cliff, there's a big train accident or whatever, you'll find these days that the British ambassador and the consul are there within minutes, because the British public are such travellers that almost certainly there will be some Brits involved in the accident. And you, the media, will be there within seconds saying, what are you doing about this? And where is the ambassador and what is the consul doing? If you take the Herald of Free Enterprise that sank off the coast of Belgium, the ambassador was there within an hour or so. And the only communications available then was, believe it or not, was the days before digital telephony, was the telephone in the ambassador's car, which was used to convey everything that was happening on the ground back to London. So, I mean, I hope people's views have changed from these rather old-fashioned ones. And, for example, residences, which can be very grand, I would call them people's palaces rather than white elephants these days. You walk into any residence, any decent-sized ones, you'll find on plinths a vacuum cleaner, an F.G. Wilson generator, those nice blue ones from not very far from here, other displaying the sort of products that are made in Britain and Northern Ireland and that we wish to promote in any given market. And I hope that the more, and the sort of trade promotion aspect, the salesmanship that you referred to, and bringing people in to see what we can do for them as diplomats from our embassies. I used to run a think tank. I'd invite 100 people to lunch, get someone distinguished over to speak to them. And I was told in later years that it played a very important role in the politics of that country, because since their revolution, the different parties had never met on common ground. They did so at the British Embassy and those sort of think tank lunches. So you can play a huge number of roles. With European football championships, I had the house full of England fans trying to tame them to behave well, which they did in that particular set of championships. And I hope that these kinds of activities mean that the public image is changing.
Before I ask you the same question, Noel, let's just look at this very short clip from the ambassadors, which exploits the caricature, it would have to be said, if it is a caricature.
Sugary and grey
Your Excellency, lovely to see you again. Darling, you remember Mark, the French ambassador?
Jennifer.
Mark.
You are looking beautiful as ever.
Thank you so much.
How delightful to be here. You're not wearing your furry hunting hat tonight, Elmer.
No. Petra. Your Excellency, thank you so much for coming.
Delighted to be here.
Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
Lovely outfit.
Thank you so much.
You know Mark, of course.
Ambassador, how fares the Euro? And I hear there's to be some British entertainment tonight.
Beyond the cooking, that is.
Yes, outside you can learn how to make a British pork pie. And after dinner, I'm delighted to say that Stephen Pembridge will be performing his one-man adaptation of Frankenstein.
Not him again.
Haven't the British Council got anyone else they send? They put me through his Martin Chuzzlewit in Ankara last year.
It was longer than sorrow.
Now let me tempt you both with an Eccles cake.
Ladies and gentlemen, in order to properly reflect the duality at the heart of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I will be playing both the part of Dr. Frankenstein, the experimental chemist, at the University of Ingolstadt. I questioned whence did the principle of life proceed. And I will also be playing the accursed creature he creates.
Cursed creator! I have glutted myself with freaks and misery!
This approach has never before been attempted.
Yeah, I guess you can take that salesmanship approach too far, can't you, with the Eccles cakes?
I think that's a top gear approach to diplomacy.
Top gear approach to diplomacy, yeah. How do you think diplomats are seen in Ireland by non-diplomats?
Well, I think what Lynn said about how diplomats are seen in Britain is reflected very much in how they're seen in Ireland. I mean, people have kind of more than slightly exaggerated views, yes, of what diplomats do until they actually get to deal with them. And Lynn is right. I mean, for any ambassador, any head of mission in any post abroad, any bilateral post abroad, the absolute priority has to be the protection of the interests of your citizens. And that comes to the fore most obviously when citizens are in trouble of one kind or another. People get to know how important the embassy can be when they have a problem. And they usually, not always, but they usually come out of that experience with a pretty positive view. I mean, I wouldn't say the longest day's work I've done in my life, but close to the longest day's work I've done in my life was as a junior diplomat in New Delhi, when I had to deal with an extremely urgent consular case when somebody had to be got out of India as fast as possible. And I started working on the issue at 7:30 in the morning, and I put that person on the plane at 2:30 the following morning, and I was with him all that day, both in taking him to the doctor and various other things. That wouldn't be unusual for junior diplomats in our service, especially in difficult posts. So I think if people actually deal with diplomats, and this applies to business people, residences are not, well, first of all, any ambassador thinks a residence has been provided for his or her edification, has got it wrong. I mean, we live in these big houses to keep these big houses open to our citizens and make them available to our citizens. And using residences to promote companies, to promote interests, Irish interests, happens every day of the week now. I know I'll just take London as an example, though Washington you could take as an example as well. I know that the Food Board uses the embassy in London very frequently. Same was certainly true in Washington, same would be true in New York. The industries use the embassies, and that has become much more common in the last 20 years. I'm not saying people won't always be happy, won't always be satisfied with what diplomats do, like any other civil servants. We have our faults, things don't always go right. But most of the time, I think diplomats do deliver. They deliver to the citizen, and they're conscious of that. Mm. I mean, if you're not conscious of that, if you're not conscious of your obligation to serve your country and to serve the citizen, well, then you shouldn't really be in the job.
Glyn, do you think politicians appreciate diplomats, or is there a bit of tension in that relationship?
I think there is a difference between politicians who have not yet had ministerial office and are opposing, as is their job to oppose, and look at budgets and, you know, all this extravagance. Why is, you know, so much being spent on this, that, and the other? And why does this embassy cost so much money? And those who come into office who become extremely addicted to the flow of information, because one of the key aspects of a diplomat's life is to be familiar with the issues of the day, and for the minister to be familiar with the issues of the day across a very broad front indeed. They get very addicted to the what used to be described as a Rolls-Royce service. I'm not sure, I cannot say that the service is as Rolls-Royce as it used to be, because I think the quote, efficiency savings that have gone on over the last 15 years have been pretty dramatic. And, you know, inevitably an organization will suffer from that. But the duty that that first clip referred to, the ethos is very strong, so people will always try and do their best. If you take someone like the leader of the Labour Party, who has been known for all the questions he's asked of the Foreign Office over the years, always extremely critical. Since he became leader and is no doubt receiving some degree of briefings as to what's going on across the world, perhaps he has modified his views, I don't know. So I think in the House of Commons you'll find a lot of friends of the Foreign Office who know what they do, and some who know less about it but would like to know more by virtue of having office.
Do you think there's a kind of diplomatic personality? A type of person that tends to get these jobs?
I think not for a long time. I think, you know, the first era when Douglas Hurd and John Kerr were shown in the sort of very early days, there was in the bowler hatted brigade. Yes, but nowadays I think they recruit many more women than they do men. There are many people who come from outside. There is an antagonism to the public school traditional diplomat. They want people from as broad a group as possible, from ethnic minorities.
Everyone in that film was educated at Oxford, was a
white
male.
Yeah, and was a white male. Exactly. That, I think, has long since gone by the board.
Yes, I just want, not on that point, because we obviously don't have the same tradition. One thing
about you were all educated at Trinity.
Of course, there are people from Trinity. There are lots of people from UCD as well. I was going to just on the use of residences. It occurred to me the residence in Washington was the scene of a number of fairly memorable bringing togethers, if you like, of people from this part of the island at various events related. To efforts by the Clinton administration to support the peace process. And certainly in my time, we opened up the house even more to people of the unionist persuasion. Indeed, I remember Peter Robinson led a DUP delegation to Washington in my time, and we offered a briefing. It was entirely up to the DUP what contacts they had with the American administration. That was arranged through the consulate in New York. Sorry, the consulate here in Belfast, the American consulate. But we offered a briefing on, you know, the people they would meet and so on. And they accepted it. And I said, let's have them round to tea in the residence. And my rather wise first secretary said, why don't we invite them to dinner? And we did. And they came to dinner, and we had a very, very enjoyable dinner. They certainly made no concessions to me or to the Irish system, as to their fundamental position.
Yes.
But they were very interested. I mean, people up here are very practical and very pragmatic.
Yes. Was that a dry dinner?
It was actually, yeah. Yes. Now that you come to think of it. It was.
Yeah.
But the residents, not just in Washington, but also in London, became the kind of place where people could go and talk to each other. Mm. And that is a role that diplomats play. And while you might think of these big houses, and they are big houses.
Yeah.
They are there for a purpose, and they have to be used for this purpose. And there are many purposes, whether it's
indeed,
trade or...
But as we discovered from the WikiLeaks that came out of the American consulate in Belfast, when any of us, even I and the media who have gone through some of these consulate events, when we say something, it's likely to be jotted down at some point by someone like yourselves, perhaps a little bit of political gossip that comes from a journalist or from another politician, and it ends up in an email back to the head office, doesn't it?
But you see, that, of course, is the key job of a diplomat, is to know what is going on and to know the personalities.
Yeah.
And that's the skill. You're learning to read people. You want to know what it is that they think about the particular issues of the day, what their influences are, if they are important, because at the end of the day, if you have, let us say, a top-notch negotiator like a Jonathan Powell floating into town who doesn't know the people yet, tell me about these people. What is it that what do they like doing? Do they like trampolining with dogs? You know, what are the issues? What are the personal aspects as much as the political aspects?
Big interest trampolining that one.
There's no such thing as a casual conversation with a diplomat. You do actually make a note.
But at what point does that edge into spycraft?
Sorry?
Spycraft.
No, it's information.
Just information.
It's frankly, you want to be in a position to inform your government about the key players, what they think, how is it that they're going to react to a particular issue. We have some particular EU issue. What is it that the French think about this? Are they going to be difficult? Almost certainly yes. Can we change their minds? Almost certainly no. Is it worth trying? Yes. Thus it goes. Nothing to do with anything more sinister.
Never seen any spycraft in your game, no?
Well, we don't do spycraft.
No, no. Of course not. No.
Yeah. No, on WikiLeaks, when I was in the Holy See, I was actually at the Irish Club of Rome Christmas party when I got a phone call from the head of press in Dublin saying, your embassy is in WikiLeaks. Now, fortunately, the party was taking place quite close to our residence, which was also our office, so I went back to the office to see what exactly was
pretty
said.
Pretty quickly,
I was quite impressed by the accuracy of the American cable. I would have put a couple of things about the Irish Church slightly differently.
Right.
But what it attributed to us, to especially to my number two, was there was nothing exceptional in it.
And you wouldn't have been offended because you were doing the same with them.
Well, of course, but I also I suspect that 95% of what was in WikiLeaks is unexceptional, and it must be because nobody has published vast volumes of WikiLeaks, and large volumes of diplomatic cables can be very, very boring.
Right. Very boring indeed.
But this is one of the challenges now of modern diplomacy, isn't it? This digital revolution, and we live in the context of all of that.
Absolutely, and I think that is also changing to a degree public perceptions. There's an extraordinary new book out by a colleague called Tom Fletcher called The Naked Diplomat, who goes totally digital as ambassador to the Lebanon, and who is tweeting and blogging about all his activities in a manner that has never been done before, and I suspect it's not going to be done again, to the point that he's having a tweet-up with the Prime Minister of Lebanon, which is retweeted by the President of Iran, which is quite, going some. But if you could imagine an entire diplomatic corps tweeting and blogging, you'd drive your host government insane, you'd have competition among the diplomatic corps, you'd probably have a game show, Diplo Tweet of the Week, as it were. It's not tenable. And the other aspect of it, of course, is diplomacy has to be based on trust. And a certain degree, if you are doing serious negotiations, like the peace process, which you've heard about, the kinds of things that Jonathan Powell was talking about, they have to be kept very quiet, under the radar. Mm. And I think because of WikiLeaks, because of leaks and so on, a certain amount of very key negotiations are going to gravitate away from foreign ministries to third track, to organizations like Intermediate, like the great San Egidio, who more or less delivered the peace settlement in Mozambique. People who can, groups who have the connections, who have the ability to listen and understand what the issues are for the key players, and to feed those quietly in to the point that they can, someone can come together and make that a peace settlement. Mm. And so I think that the Tom Fletcher approach is absolutely wonderful. But he did have number 10 behind him,
yes, that helps,
which made a lot of difference. Yeah. You know, for the average ambassador, the chances of putting a foot wrong are pretty high, which means that most tweets and blogs from ambassadors are extremely boring.
Mm.
Yeah. I agree about trust. I think trust is absolutely vital. And I don't see how you can maintain trust when you're involved in a negotiation if you're tweeting every 2 minutes what you're doing and what you're saying. It's very hard to see how you can reach agreement. And I agree there's a need for as much openness as possible, and we're being forced into a position of as much openness as possible in any event by the change in the speed of communication. When I joined the Foreign Service, there were two ways of communicating. There were telegrams or telexes, and there was the diplomatic bag. There was the written dispatch that was put in the bag and sent off and got to Dublin a week later, maybe sooner. Now, emails democratize the exchange of information within the system.
Yes.
It used to require photocopying and approval of circulation and so on before a cable would get round even within the ministry, never mind within the whole civil service. Now it can be done literally in a couple of seconds.
Yes.
That has opened things up and made it more public within the system and inevitably more public outside the system. We have much more oversight by politicians in the sense that when I joined the service and up to the 1980s, there was no Foreign Affairs Committee in Parliament in Dublin. There has been now, and there has been for 30 years, and officials go to talk to that committee every time it meets and think nothing of it.
Yeah. Just on that emails thing, though, just to remind ourselves, you know, America's leading diplomat at the time, Hillary Clinton, who's now running for president, is involved in just this issue about the transparency of emails and whether they were fully encrypted and confidential. And now Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State, has been exposed, his email has been exposed for the last 3 years by DC Leaks website, and we discover in those emails that Israel has 200 nuclear warheads trained on Iran, he says. Now, this is the former Secretary of State saying this. We've all known that, but it's interesting that an email from the former number one diplomat in America has now come out confirming what we all suspected. The nuclear ambiguity is now gone. That's the danger of emails for a diplomat, isn't it?
It is, though on the other side of things, and I think Glenn will agree with me here, if you have four levels of classification of your cables from unrestricted up to secret, the natural sense of self-importance, which we all have, makes sure that we very rarely unrestrict and make it secret more often than it should be. A lot of what is restricted and secret is not really restricted and secret.
Really?
Now, that might be, but they, well,
shopping certainly, lists, things like that. You know?
There is a, well, it makes you feel more important.
But I think one of the dangers, in a sense, is you now have what you might call the citizen diplomat, which is, you know, anyone who reads an interesting article in the newspapers on something, you know, you can, you know, comment here. And, you know, the individual is now empowered to be as much a diplomat as anybody else. And that can create sort of sudden surges of shifts of public opinion, which can be misinterpreted. They can be short-term, and they're not actually very soundly based. I think we're living in a world now where the speed of communication and their vulnerability to attack and to hacking, which is the other reason you're not going to have sort of the world diplomat sweeping, because it is too easy to attack. My day job is in security these days, and it is too easy to hack the individual, the infrastructure, whatever the case may be. We're living in a world we haven't quite come to terms with. I think it's still evolving. How we can still do the jobs of international relations and bilateral relations in a manner that is secure where it needs to be.
I'm going to play another clip, but just to you know all about this, of course, you just referenced it. True Brits, the book by Ruth Dudley Edwards, who's here this weekend, obviously, accompanied a BBC television series made in 1994. I'm going to see a clip from that. But what's interesting is a backstory to this, is it took 10 years of negotiations between the BBC and the Foreign Office for access to get permission to do that series, to make it possible. Then when they gave the access, they gave a lot of access, which is reflected in this. We're also going to see a clip from Our Man at the Vatican, which is part of the story of Francis Campbell, who's also here, the former British ambassador to the Holy See. Let's have a look at those. We'll talk about them.
Heavy fighting is continuing in the Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, after yesterday's bombardment, which killed at least 19 people. The intense battles come as the warring factions prepare for the International Peace Conference, which is due to begin in London in 3 days' time.
It is much more interesting and exciting being in London than overseas. The excitement, I think, is in the policy of being close to the centre, where decisions are made. The demands are enormous, the hours are ridiculous, but the intellectual excitement is wonderful.
I personally think it is a great mistake to be self-conscious about being a woman in a world that is largely dominated by men, and I never have been. But it is more difficult for women, I accept absolutely. And particularly those who are married, who have families and commitments. It's a very demanding profession. I think, Minister, there's also the fact, too, that at the moment we're presidency and we're not showing any leadership. There are other states who, you know, have undertaken to take quite large numbers. The ICRC process of evacuation of the camps has now come to full halt because they're not getting enough offers. If the UK was in a position to make an offer now, once, you know, of a generous sounding number, that would shame quite a lot of other countries into following suit quite rapidly.
Is this something the Cabinet's got to decide?
I can't answer that.
Well, I suspect... I think she's an unusual character. Whether she's an unusual character by the standards of the Foreign Office, I'm not sure, but she's an unusual character. She's rather in a sense, in the mould of some of those 19th century English ladies who went travelling in the Middle East in very hard conditions. She likes hands-on, no doubt about it, and in a sense, very good thing, too.
It's unbelievable. A car is just like a paper bag. The bullet will go straight through the door, the seat, the gear stick, and out through the other seat and door without even deviating from its route. It's extraordinary. Here we go. I will be swift across here. Larry's lamp pencil.
I didn't get a shot.
The problem is on this street we're in direct line from behind us.
It's now high summer and a red letter day inside the Vatican. For the past 5 years, these formal occasions have been part and parcel of Francis's working life. But this will be the last time he attends this special Mass as British Ambassador to the Holy See. It's only a matter of months until he has to leave Rome for a new and as yet unknown appointment.
After the visit, it's curtains really, because I come back here and I start packing. And already my mind is beginning to move on to, you know, what will my life be like by the end of this year? Because it won't be like this. And where will you be and what will you be doing and will you be happy?
Someone who can empathise with the transient and uncertain life of a diplomat is Francis's Irish counterpart, Ambassador Noel Fahey.
It's part and parcel of diplomat's life, inevitably, because you're required to serve in embassies and consulates throughout the world. I've moved 5 times to different countries, and once within a country when I was ambassador in Germany.
Yes.
The longer you stay in a post, I think the more inclined you are to see the point of view of the country you're in, and the more inclined you are to grow away from the views of your own country. So fairly regular moves, I think, are an essential part of the operation.
We're part of this global village, and you know, you meet people here who you may have worked with 12 years ago, and I know that that will happen in other places as well.
The diplomats are good at building relationships, maintaining relationships, and using relationships in a positive sense. You don't get anywhere by just abusing relationships or taking everything out of it to your own benefit and nothing to the benefit of the person with whom you have the relationship. It's a two-way thing.
Everyone's asking you, what are you going to be doing? And you can't tell them because you don't know what you're going to be doing. And I thought, it looked at one stage, London was the definite place. Maybe London is not now the definite place. And it's that degree of uncertainty that you don't know what part of the world you could be in a few months' time.
Oh, no, you're
as a diplomat, you build up a circle of friends. You live in a house. You develop friendships with the staff. You have friends in the city. And you basically pack all that up and go. So as the visit approaches, it's this huge professional task ahead, a very enjoyable task, but there's also there's a personal story going on as well, and the personal story is literally the unknown.
Francis Campbell, and Francis went on from that. He got a new appointment, obviously, to Pakistan after that, and then eventually left the service, and is now Vice Chancellor of St Mary's University in London. You cut a dash, incidentally, in a white tie. But if I were you, I would hold out for the plumage. A bit more plumage. The Irish Foreign Service needs some plumes.
Thank heavens we don't have a uniform. That's all.
Well, is that the first time you've seen that footage ever?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Of yourself in 1992?
Mm-hmm. I've seen some later bits of it under Shelfar, because that long stretch was Sniper's Alley in Sarajevo. But I'd never seen that particular clip before.
How come?
Well, when it was shown on BBC, I happened to be in Sarajevo. I couldn't sort of bring myself to sit down and watch myself, if you see what I mean. It seemed to me sort of slightly unnatural.
Gosh. Watch this next one. I want to ask you a question about it. It's very short, but have a look at this.
The world's going to stay difficult and dangerous. The old dangers, new dangers. They can only be tackled if all the substantial countries work together more effectively than ever before. The United States has to give the lead. That means a consistent commitment by president and administration, of course, also by Congress and right across this country. You can't be a superpower just going in and out of subjects according to what's on the TV screen.
Douglas Hurd, former Foreign Secretary, of course, in the search for peace. And in just 34 seconds there, it takes us into a lot of issues. The role of America in the world today, the only remaining superpower, hyperpower. And you can't do diplomacy without relating to America in the world today. And the new dangers, as he describes them, the new dangers that diplomats have to be involved in. What are those dangers from your perspective, Noel?
Well, I suppose the new dangers from our point of view are the apparent, I would say, breakdown, but certainly decline in the role of the European Union with the departure of Britain. I mean, this presents a whole new challenge for the Irish Foreign Service and for the Irish system as a whole, which we're probably coming to terms with, or not coming to terms with, about as quickly as the British are coming to terms themselves with the implications of Brexit. I think the slow, very slow recovery from the crisis of 2008 has had a huge impact on politics throughout the so-called Western world, the developed world. People feel that they've lost out. They feel resentful. That's been shown in the rise of Donald Trump in the United States, Brexit. the rise of right-wing movements in Europe. This has an impact on the international institutions. That creates new dangers. So we have a problem of the, in Ireland's case, of the international institution in which we place most trust, that's the European Union, going through a crisis, at the same time as our closest neighbour and trading partner and political partner.
Yep.
We share an island together and an common interest, a major common interest. So in fact, if I were a young Irish diplomat now, I'd be rubbing my hands with glee at the number of issues that I'm likely to have to deal with. May you live in interesting times in that sense, because if times are unsettled, it's a challenge. It challenges diplomats and brings out the best in them.
I wonder what the general response was within the Foreign Office when the referendum decision was announced and Britain was going for Brexit.
Well, I'm long since retired, so I can't answer that, but I am pretty certain it was shock horror. And I think that one of the true statements that was made by the Brexiteers during the campaign was Michael Gove's, "Nobody pays any attention to experts," one of the few true ones. What I suspect that people did not realize is that deaccession from something like the European Union is as complicated as accession. Mm. It takes something like 7-10 years, if you're accepted, because you have to go through every sector of the economy, more or less tariff heading by tariff heading. I spent a lot of my career doing this in the European Union in London. It is immensely complicated, and this time you've got the UK alone against the other member states, but the Commission will make the proposals, and it will take a two-thirds majority to overturn those proposals. It's not tough, so I entirely agree with Noel. I mean, Brexit is a huge and difficult challenge. Secondly, I think the world is as about as unstable a place as ever we have known it since the end of the Second World War.
Yeah.
And the latent or active conflicts around the world are threatening and very real. Mm. We have a very unpredictable electoral process in the United States. No one knows who's going to win and what their commitments will be. I don't know about anyone else, but I'm as scared as can be about the prospects of a President Trump, and to put it mildly.
How difficult would that be diplomatically, dealing with President Trump's administration?
Diplomats, when someone accedes to power, diplomats turn to the right, smartly salute and get on with the job. And
yes.
I have not the slightest doubt that the British Embassy in Washington, and I'm sure the Irish Embassy too, are following the Trump campaign with people on the ground, getting to know all the personalities just as much as they're following the Clinton campaign. We always do it.
You just work with it. It's a reset.
You have to get on with it because you can't afford not to. And I think, again, one thing we touched a bit on digital diplomacy earlier, when you look at what the Maleficent are doing with digital technology, Jonathan Powell here mentioned earlier ISIS and the way they took Mosul. That was preceded by 40,000 tweets a day. Mm. You know, the impact of terrorism is to magnify the impact. They magnified the impact using technology and the barbarisms that they were going to commit on the people of Mosul to the fact that tens of thousands of Iraqis actually ran away before 2,000 people. So you've got an awful lot of variables that we're not terribly well placed to control. So I have to say, it's not a very good moment for Brexit.
Do you think, what's your view on the Brexit thing?
Strategic mistake for the UK. I mean, the European Union has a number of little tiny flaws. We both admit that. I mean, it is one of those clips, I think, was scripted by Boris Johnson, the one about all the sort of, from Yes Minister, about the paper mill that produces statements after statements and oh my God, which make no difference at all except to the wallpaper industry. There are areas of great success and efficacy in the European Union, and there are others which are still what you might call embryonic. And whatever its strength and weaknesses, frankly, I think it was a strategic mistake to vote against, my personal view.
Do you reckon, Glyn, that the Foreign Office culture is really being challenged now by I would guess the Foreign Office would share your view generally that
I suspect,
being
yes.
in the European Union was just taken for granted. It was part of what we do in foreign affairs. But now there's a foreign secretary who was a Brexiteer, and that represents it in itself quite a challenge to the culture.
I'm sure that the Foreign Office is serving the Foreign Secretary as loyally as they have served any of his predecessors. Sorry about that. Good try.
Yes, we just a return to orthodoxy. Before we come to the audience, I'm going to give you a chance to ask some questions. One final clip. It's only 3 minutes, but it's also from the Palace of Dreams where we started, and it's looking into the future for diplomacy.
Lord Palmerston's palace was built to protect and promote Britain's interests across the globe. But in recent years, the Foreign Office has suffered both from the No. 10 takeover of foreign policy and from Treasury spending cuts, raising the question whether this great office of state is now more show than substance.
The whole weight of the Foreign Office has become less. I think that Tony Blair assisted in that process. I think we're diminishing our overall representation. I think that some particular closures of posts are unwise. And I have a feeling, as I've said in debate, that the Foreign Office itself, the process of advice in London, has become somewhat hollowed out. You don't have quite those reserves of experience and wisdom available to the Foreign Secretary which there used to be.
Do you accept this idea that the Foreign Office has been hollowed out?
No, I think that's nonsense. I think the Foreign Office is every bit as capable as it was, every bit as well manned as it was. I think that the nature of foreign policy has changed and is changing and will carry on changing, and that you will get more done between leaders themselves, and that will mean that there is less for ambassadors to do. As communications change, say old-fashioned telegrams, or before that, letters were the key way of communicating, and often would take weeks and months to come back to England. Now it's all just as the 24-hour news, you have 24-hour diplomacy.
Well, the people who alerted me first, oddly enough, to the decline in the relative position of the Foreign Office in the constellation of departments were my friends in the Secret Intelligence Service.
MI6?
Yep. And they first alerted me by telling me how they were really quite upset at the number of research analysts being cut back. Because the first people the SIS would try their special stuff on were the research analysts of the Foreign Office to see what was new and what wasn't. And they felt rather bereft because they were being thinned out because of budget cuts. But one of them put it really rather wonderfully, veteran of the Cold War. He said to me, "The two pillars that sustained my service, the Secret Intelligence Service, for the bulk of my time, have both gone. The Soviet Union and the Foreign Office." And that's when I realized how serious it was getting.
The Foreign Office never publicly expresses doubts about its superior status. Yet in recent times, it's often seemed to resemble less a great office of state and more a palace of dreams.
Gosh, not a terribly optimistic upsum for that exploration of the Foreign Office. Is British diplomacy in trouble?
Well, I think if one goes back to the Douglas Head quote and the Jonathan Pearl quote, I think actually both are right. I think the Foreign Office has been hollowed out. It has lost a lot of staff, and it can no longer do as much as it used to do, and that does have an effect. Equally, I think Jonathan's absolutely right in saying that the nature of diplomacy is changing. It's not necessarily all been done by a building in Whitehall. It is now being done by a variety of entities. And the skill is in organizing or being able to absorb the input or to ask the various entities to do their bit. You're using third-track diplomacy, you're using first-track diplomacy, you're using number 10, you're using special representatives. There are a lot of different elements. Mm. So what you need is very clear political leadership and a strategy. And there are those around who say that strategy has somewhat been lacking. I hope very much that that is not the case and that it will a very clear view, as we sort ourselves out over Brexit, will emerge. So I think there are a lot of question marks, I would say, but I don't share this view that everything shifting to number 10 is a bad thing. I think it is actually very important that number 10 play a key role. It adds clout, it's indisputable it adds clout, and sure enough, a lot of the people, the key players in number 10 who support the Prime Minister on foreign policy are seconded from the foreign ministry and then go back. So, as I say, state of flux, not quite clear how it's going to work out, but I don't see it as all bad.
I guess...
I agree. I mean, I think in our system, the Taoiseach's office has a very important role to play because, partly because other departments, the Finance Ministry, the Treasury, the Department of, I suppose, let's call it Economic Affairs, Employment in Kildare Street, and Trade, they have all, over the years, acquired a greater and greater involvement internationally, and somebody in the end has to bring all these things together.
Foreign direct investment, all that.
One other area, and it's not one that I don't know the answer to, but it goes back to an old problem of there's an awful lot of information out there. Who brings it together? Who puts it in a form where it can be transmitted around the system? And who helps the people who take the decisions take the decisions? And that's very difficult. It's even more difficult now than it's ever been. And that's the task for foreign ministers.
And for the future. A couple of questions from you. If you'd like to ask a question, right over there, straight away, two there. It's like an auction house. Over this side as well. We've got mics moving around. Gentleman at the front here. That was the first hand I saw, so let's go there. And we'll move the other mic around so we go to it fast. Thank you. No. Put your hand up again. Thank you very much. This chap here. Thank you very much.
Hello there.
Well, hello.
Hello. I'm just wondering about the well-known in the American appointment of ambassadors, the 70-30 rule, that 30% of diplomatic appointments will be professional diplomats and 30% will be party donors, friends of the president and stuff. I was just wondering what would be your opinion of that sort of... practice, and would any similar practice have ever happened in Ireland or Britain?
Political appointments rather than the career diplomatic kind of approach that you see in America, with big party donors getting ambassadorships as a reward. Yeah. What do you make of that approach to diplomacy? Can it work? Have you ever seen anything like that this side of the Atlantic?
Yeah, we sometimes kind of look, not so much look down on the Americans, but kind of say, it's a bit odd they're appointing these party hacks. Now, these people, by and large, are not party hacks. They're usually fairly well-qualified people who know what they're doing. The important thing with an American ambassador is, I think, is if you have an American ambassador in your capital who can get somebody in the White House to answer his phone calls, and you can be quite sure that somebody who has contributed a large amount of money to the president's campaign is going to get the White House, whether it's the president himself or the National Security Council, to answer the phone. And that is important for you, for your country. I mean, Jean Kennedy Smith was an extremely influential ambassador in Dublin, and there have been a series of very influential American ambassadors in London who have not been career ambassadors. That's not to say that there aren't very good career ambassadors in the US system. There are. But that is the US system, and the Americans are used to it. The system is built to accommodate the kind of issues that a mixture of career and non-career cause. And American career diplomats have quite an array of protections from their position being abused by people appointed from outside. In our system, effectively, there's only been one appointee from outside that obviously, when the system was set up in the 20s, it came out of that revolutionary period.
Yeah.
But since then, as far as I know, there's only been one appointee from outside the service, the civil service. A couple of people have been appointed from other departments. But by and large, in fact, in the vast majority of cases, people have been appointed from inside the service. And the reason for that is, if you make another politician an ambassador, it's harder to tell that ambassador what to do if he's a politician like you. It's much easier to tell a civil servant what to do.
Yeah. Suppose one comes to mind for Britain is Paul Boateng, who used to be an MP, then became ambassador to South Africa.
having previously been a minister, and I mean, we have very few political appointments. Washington is almost always, if not a politician, someone who is very close to number 10 for exactly the reasons that Noel has set out, and a couple of other places as well. And I think Paul Boateng was terribly keen to go there. One of the problems, the American system is well-oiled, and the number two is always a professional diplomat, because diplomacy, like it or not, is a trade, and there are skills and there are techniques that you need to know. So the number two will guide the political appointment in what he is doing. Boateng, I prefer not to talk about, because he's a nice man. I know he had his problems in South Africa. In our case, I think what is happening more, and I think I find more troubling, is promoting civil servants who are not diplomats into ambassadorial posts, whose reference points are London and Whitehall battles, and they don't know much about abroad unless it's Brussels. And that, I think, is much more difficult to cope with. There has been something of a belief in Whitehall that, you know, anybody can be an ambassador, doesn't have to be a diplomat, you know, and if you've come from the Treasury or you've come from the Ministry of Agriculture, you can do it just as well as anybody else. That one, I think, is much more difficult and rather more suspect as an argument.
Yes,
Who's got the mic this time? Where are we? Yep, go for it. Have you got the mic? Nice and loud, please.
Firstly, Dame Glynn, great choice of car. Secondly...
With French car, was it? Was Italian?
No, it was Roland Scimitar.
Great choice. I hope you still have it. Often diplomats are posted overseas and then brought back to headquarters or to London or to either house. But I'm aware of, in some foreign services, of diplomats being transferred from country A to country B. What do the panel think? Thank you.
It's very easy to become disconnected from your home country. And I think it does happen, you're quite right, and people can go on a sort of round and so on. And you're getting an impression of your country largely from the media and your home leave. And the rate of change over the last 30 years has been so extraordinary in the UK that unless you spend long periods of time here, you could really be representing a country you don't very much recognize anymore. Sure. And I think that's the danger. I used to harbor a pet project that people should be seconded for 6 months to civil society, go off and do something useful in their own community, to learn what the UK is really about at ground level. And it would always got a lot of support at the topmost level, but when it came to personnel department,
not going to be doing
never
that.
Got off the ground.
Got time for two more points or questions from the floor, because, who's got the mic? Why don't you hand the mic to someone, Thank you very much.
Sorry, could you make us aware of what you mean, what the training process is to become a diplomat? I mean, you both mentioned doing exams or an entrance kind of exam. But, I mean, what's training after that? You make the difference between diplomats and civil servants. That's not really part of our, that's not something, these distinctions don't mean much to us.
Is there a course you can take?
Let me answer it this way. I used to be a volunteer advisor for Citizens Advice, which I think is a wonderful organization. And they sent me, as they do for most volunteers after they've been there a year or so, on a course on how to listen. I said, I know how to listen. I've been doing it for the last 34 years. They said, you don't. And it was absolutely extraordinary, because those of you who are volunteers for Citizens Advice will know that when you're dealing with Open Door, you are not allowed to ask leading questions. You're reading body language. Okay, one's used to that. But the way you deal with people, with your clients and Citizens Advice, is quite different from being a diplomat. To go back to your specific question, the exams are, to enter the Foreign Office, you have to have either a first-class degree or a postgraduate, no, first or second-class degree or a postgraduate degree. If you haven't got that, you do a whole series of exams ending up with a final board. In my day, the training was on the job. You were taught by your superiors, particularly the assistant head of the department, who taught you how to draft, how to deal with people. It all came from experience and by being let out to go and do some low-level contacts, and if you got that right, you were allowed to do more. And I have to say the training worked very well.
Yeah.
Nowadays, we have a diplomatic academy that was set up by William Hague that runs courses for the diplomatic service. I mean, quite apart from language training, which has always been a key thing, how to negotiate. There are a whole range of courses that can be done. The difference between a civil servant, let us say, from the Treasury, now, you won't be surprised to hear that I'm fairly prejudiced where the Treasury is concerned, but my view of the Treasury officials is they're trained to be brutal. They're trained to be absolutely bloody-minded and hit you over the head whenever they possibly can, usually with quite strong language. you're going off to be an ambassador. It's not necessarily the best approach.
No.
Now, I'm exaggerating because anyone who isn't in the Treasury will always feel hard done by them. But there are techniques that you learn either by experience or through courses.
Unless you're the ambassador from the Philippines.
Sorry?
It
doesn't matter what in. I mean, you know, the requirement used to be a good degree, if you like, or a postgraduate degree. And traditionally, all those bowler-hatted guys would have had degrees in what was called greats, Latin and Greek. You know, thoroughly good preparation.
You had a PhD in Latin American studies, didn't you?
History. Yeah.
One final question. Thank you very much.
I wouldn't add very much to that. I mean, certainly Glenn's experience is the same as mine. First or second class honours degree are equivalent, postgraduate.
Do you have an academy now?
No, we don't actually. There was an idea that there would be one, but it's a casualty of austerity. We tend on some of these things to follow behind the British, but a respectful number of
years. You'd like an academy, but you've
won it. It would be very much like the British system. Perhaps the examination will be, there's one written examination, and then there's a very tough board. It's hard to get into. It's surprisingly.
And you call an interview system a board, do you? It's a tough board.
Well, it would be an interview board. Yes.
But you call that a board, yeah.
I know board can mean something slightly different.
BBC uses the same language.
Yeah, yes,
selection board. Yeah.
Selection board.
Seems to be all part of a system there. I haven't been to this side of the floor. All right.
Hello. I'm currently the Honorary Consul for the Slovak Republic in Northern Ireland, and I wanted to ask the panel, given the financial constraints that diplomatic services are under across the globe, do they see an enhanced role for people like myself who are not from a career diplomatic background in taking on some of the, but nevertheless have contacts that they've built up over the years and happen to be based in that locality when the ambassador or the prime minister or president roll into town? Do they see that developing further in the future?
So any future enhancement of the role of honorary consuls? Does Ireland have any honorary
yes,
consuls?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we have quite a few honorary consuls. So when I was in India, we had one in Bombay, who had very close connections with this part of the world. His brother was head of the Methodist Church in Ireland. Yeah. Since then, I know that in India that there are three or four more honorary consuls. So yes, we use honorary consuls. A lot depends. It can sometimes be difficult to get right, to get the right person who will give the right amount of time and who will get the right result for himself, him or herself out of it. But yes, honorary consuls do have a role, and we've used them ever since the 1920s.
Do you think with cuts you might end up using them more?
No, often? I don't, because it's a different job representing your country formally to a government. An honorary consul is entitled to look after the interests of the citizens, and that's in consular matters. Now, consular matters in its broadest sense, which can include trade, certainly includes protection of individual rights. Beyond that actual representation to government, I can never see an honorary consul doing that.
All right.
I agree with everything Noel said. I mean, we use a lot of honorary consuls, and more so indeed with cuts. But absolutely not getting into government. Indeed, I've known honorary consuls have to resign because they disagreed with the policies of the government.
I'm being guillotined, unfortunately. So many people want to ask more questions, but we have time to hang around and have a chat afterwards, I'm sure. Shall we thank our two wonderful ambassadors, Noel and Glenn? Thank you both very much. Wonderful.